The U.S. prepares more sanctions against Russia.
Officials say the sanctions will, quote, hold Russia accountable for what happened to Alexei Navalny, as well as the two-year war in Ukraine.
Plus, protests return to the Poland-Ukraine border.
A lot of Ukrainian farmers actually lost their lives collecting this grain. And as Ukrainian officials mentioned, this grain, well, has Ukrainian blood on it. And seeing it spilled on the ground is, of course, quite offensive for Ukrainians.
And later, a look at Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban's power and Russia's meddling in American politics. Today is Wednesday, February 21st, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. There's new sanctions coming against Russia. We'll have that story in a few moments. First, though, a deeper dive into a story that broke yesterday. On Tuesday, the United States vetoed an Arab-backed United Nations Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. She says the resolution was vetoed because the U.S. is already working on a deal with Egypt and Qatar.
We believe that the resolution on the table right now would, in fact, negatively impact those negotiations. Demanding an immediate, unconditional ceasefire without an agreement requiring Hamas to release the hostages will not bring about a durable peace. Instead, it could extend the fighting between Hamas and Israel.
The U.S. proposed its own resolution that calls for a temporary ceasefire after a hostage deal is secured between Israel and Hamas, and it rejects an Israeli ground offensive in Rafah without civilian protection. It's the strongest leverage yet that President Joe Biden has used against Israel, a sign that his patience with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is wearing thin. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has the story.
Israel continues strikes on Gaza's southern city of Rafah, near the border with Egypt, where more than a million Palestinians, some displaced multiple times by the war, seek safety. Their fate was discussed by diplomats in New York, where on Tuesday the United States again vetoed an Arab-backed UN resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It's the third U.S. veto since Israel's military offensive on the Palestinian enclave that followed Hamas' October 7th attack on southern Israel. Palestinian UN envoy Riyad Mansour called the move reckless and dangerous.
Shielding Israel even as it commits the most shocking crimes, while exposing millions of innocent Palestinian civilians to its wrath and more untold horrors. It is not Israel that should be protected by the veto. It is Palestinian children, women, and men who must be protected by this council acting now.
The U.S. proposed its own draft resolution that calls for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza up to 6 weeks, only after a hostage deal between Israel and Hamas is secured. The U.S. is pushing for the deal with Egypt and Qatar. It also condemns the October 7th attack and makes clear that Hamas has no place in future governance of Gaza. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
In addition, our draft states there can be no reduction of territory in the Gaza Strip and rejects, as we have before, in Resolution 2720, any forced displacements of civilians in Gaza. It also highlights the concerns many council members have regarding the fate of civilians in Rafah, making clear that under current circumstances, a major ground offensive into Rafah should not proceed.
Skeptics see the U.S. resolution as a diplomatic ploy that would prolong Palestinian suffering. Israel has warned that unless the hostages held by Hamas are freed by the start of Ramadan on March 10th, it will push on with a ground offensive in Rafah. Every day there are threats and statements. We don't know where to go, said Nihal Obeid, one of the Palestinians seeking shelter there. However, the U.S. resolution does show Washington's hardening stance on Israel's conduct of the war. Richard Gowan, UN Director of the International Crisis Group, via Zoom.
This is the first time that the US has proposed a text which really does include some fairly strong implicit criticism of Israel's campaign in Gaza and the situation in the West Bank. And I think that the Biden administration may be sending a subtle sign that it will continue to protect Israel at the UN, but its patience is not limitless.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed not to bow to international pressure. This week, his war cabinet is meeting President Joe Biden's top advisor, Brett McGurk, who will push Israel to agree on the hostage deal and hold off from a ground campaign in Rafah. Patsy Widahuswara, VOA News, Washington.
President Joe Biden said Tuesday the U.S. would announce a major package of new sanctions against Russia on Friday. Reuters' Gabe Singer reports.
The U.S. is set for fresh sanctions on Russia this week.
We'll have a major package announced on Friday.
U.S. President Joe Biden told reporters from the South Lawn of the White House on Tuesday. Officials say the sanctions will, quote, hold Russia accountable for what happened to Alexei Navalny, as well as the two-year war in Ukraine. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the sanctions package would target a range of items, including the country's defense and industrial bases, as well as, quote, sources of revenue for the Russian economy that power Russia's war machine. Navalny, the fiercest domestic critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin, fell unconscious and died suddenly Friday after a walk at the Arctic prison where he was serving a three-decade sentence, according to the prison service. National Security spokesman John Kirby said the United States is pressing Russia for, quote, complete transparency on how Navalny died, while Biden has blamed Putin. A senior U.S. official said a sanctions package had already been in the works to mark the second anniversary of the war, which Washington would reconsider and supplement in response to Navalny's death. Washington previously imposed sanctions over the 2020 poisoning and imprisonment of Navalny and over Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine, including on Putin, officials, and banks.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us. Meanwhile, following the fall of Avdiivka, the Donetsk region sees major shelling, and the protests of Polish farmers have returned to the Ukraine border. But this time, they're different, more personal. I'm joined by Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
What we can see at this point is that these new protests are becoming more emotional because Polish farmers and protesters, they are spilling Ukrainian grain on the ground. This did not happen previous time when protests took place. And for Ukrainians, of course, this is a very also emotional and sad situation because Ukrainian grain is collected under the shelling, under the condition of war, and at the fields which are mined, and a lot of Ukrainian farmers actually lost their lives collecting this grain. And as Ukrainian officials mentioned, this grain, well, has Ukrainian blood on it, and seeing it spilled on the ground is, of course, quite offensive for Ukrainians and Ukrainian nation in general. So this is at this point the main issue, and it looks like this situation is not going to end soon because Polish protesters said that they are planning to continue the protest at least for a month.
As far as the military goes, there was more shelling. There continues to be more shelling in Donetsk. Can you give us an update there? Has that changed since the fall of Avdiivka?
Since the fall of Avdiivka, we can see that the shelling of Donetsk region, particularly the pre-front line areas, the pre-front line cities, have intensified, and more and more information coming in about the shelling of such cities as Slovyansk or Kramatorsk. We can see that the shelling intensified, and it looks like Russian forces took a certain pause in terms of the advance of the land force, but intensify the shelling in order to, you know, probably keep this pressure on top. But according to Ukrainian officials, at this point, Ukrainian intelligence says that they do not see any possibility for Russian forces to complete the occupation of Donetsk and Luhansk regions anytime soon. However, as I mentioned, the shelling intensified, and it's quite clear that probably reportedly, according to the official information from the Ukrainian military, Russian forces will continue to put pressure on these areas.
And how are the Ukrainian forces handling that pressure?
So according to the officials, the defense lines will remain at the position at which they are now, and Ukrainian forces will continue their fight at that positions. In terms of the personnel and equipment, Ukrainians are still waiting for additional aid from the international allies, and this is the main issue at this point, because Ukrainians do not have enough ammunition and enough equipment, so they have to save a lot of missiles, and particularly the air defense missiles, in order to make sure that they have a certain amount per day.
And you mentioned air defense missiles. I understand air defense has been in the news in Kyiv as well. Can you give us that side of the story?
Exactly. Despite the fact that Ukrainians actually have lack of this air defense missiles, at the same time, we receive confirmation from the Ukrainian air forces that in these past days, at least 5 Russian battle jets were shut down, and today was another one. And this is quite a successful case for Ukrainian military.
And we're going to leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova is in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Is Russia interfering with American politics? We'll examine that in a moment. Now a look at the man who is perhaps Vladimir Putin's closest friend in the EU and NATO. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban is the European Union's longest-serving head of state, and his critics say he's tightened his grip on power by eroding democracy. He's long been a thorn in the side of European and NATO unity, threatening to block support for Ukraine and EU sanctions on Russia. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from Budapest, Orban believes he will soon have new allies in the West.
For almost 14 years, Hungary has been led by one man, Viktor Orban. Critics say the Prime Minister has amassed power and wealth by capturing state institutions. Márton Tompos is an opposition lawmaker with the Momentum Party.
Mr. Orban's party is so intertwined with all the institutions, all the authorities, all levels of the Hungarian state, that it's not really, I would say, like a competing democracy anymore, but a hybrid regime, a spin dictatorship.
Recent estimates suggest Orban and his Fidesz party own or control up to 90% of Hungarian media. One of the few remaining independent outlets is Direct 36, co-founded by András Peto, after his previous employer, Origo, was bought by Fidesz loyalists.
We are talking about hundreds of outlets, digital, print, TV, radio, local, national, everything. They cover the whole spectrum. It's a whole media ecosystem that serves only one purpose, which is to spread the government's messages.
Those messages are increasingly targeted at the European Union. The bloc accuses Hungary of breaching the fundamental rule of law and has frozen billions of dollars in EU funds. In return, Orban has launched a propaganda campaign against the EU, with billboards declaring that it won't dance to Brussels' tune. But Orban has lost his dance partner. Poland's right-wing Law and Justice Party, a close former ally of Fidesz, was voted out of office in October. Barbara Grabowska-Moroz is a constitutional law expert from the Central European University in Budapest.
Comparing with Hungary, there is still quite independent, lots of independent media outlets in Poland. So I guess this kind of depth of process of changing the state and capturing it is just way more advanced here in Hungary.
Journalist András Peto agrees.
Orban has a much tighter control over the country. He's been working to achieve this for 3 decades. He had a lot of time. That's one thing. And the other thing is that the opposition is still in a really bad shape in Hungary.
The Hungarian government and Fidesz party did not respond to repeated VOA requests for comment, but both have denied that democracy and press freedom are under threat. Viktor Orbán's grip on power appears as strong as ever, and he will look to forge closer bonds with allies beyond Hungary as the European Union and the United States hold crucial elections later this year. Orbán makes no secret of his preference.
Nem szólhatunk bele.
In his annual televised address this month, Orbán said that Hungary can't get involved in another country's elections, but would really like President Donald Trump to return to the presidency. Orbán believes time is on his side and that soon he will no longer be standing alone on the international stage. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, Budapest.
Alexander Smirnov is accused of lying to FBI agents about Hunter Biden's business dealings in Ukraine. Those alleged lies became the basis for much of the case that Republicans are making against the Bidens. Now he says those lies came from Russian intelligence sources. So just how much is Russia meddling in American electoral politics? For more, I'm joined by VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden.
Well, Smirnov is an interesting character because he is a key witness and an FBI informant that was part of a linchpin against the case against President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. Smirnov is a businessman who said that he did business with Burisma, the Ukrainian company that Hunter Biden was involved in, that are at the center of some calls for an impeachment inquiry against the president and for investigations against Hunter Biden. And the other week, the special counsel, David Weiss, indicted Alexander Smirnov, a 43-year-old man, for lying to investigators and lying to the FBI about what was going on. Specifically, they said he lied and made false statements and created a false and fictitious record in relation to the probe and what he knew about Hunter Biden, the interactions he did, and specifically about payments that were made and when they were made. And so he's charged with lying about that.
So this is significant because much of the case that Republicans in the House of Representatives were making against Hunter and Joe Biden were based on Smirnov's testimony. What does that mean for the investigation of Hunter?
Prosecutors are saying, the special counsel is saying, he did lie about these interactions, about the timeline of these interactions, which would seem to undercut a large part of the political case that some lawmakers, Republican lawmakers in the U.S., have been making against Hunter Biden and by association with President Joe Biden. Now, it gets a little bit more interesting, though, because in court documents that were released on Tuesday, the special counsel and prosecutors went a step further about what Smirnov was up to. And they say that during an interview he had with authorities on February 14th, he admitted that not only was he lying, but that he had associated with Russian intelligence officials and that the Russian intelligence officials were involved in making up the allegations, in creating the story he was passing along to the prosecutors in the investigation of Hunter Biden. And then he goes a step further. He apparently says that he met with Russian intelligence agencies recently. He met with them this past November. They say that he is actively peddling new lies that could impact the U.S. elections, the presidential elections in 2024.
And that's, I think, the real significant part is that if proven, this would show that Russia is directly involved in interference with American politics and elections.
What intelligence officials would say, what FBI officials have said, and other law enforcement and national security officials have said, well, they refused to comment specifically on Smirnov's case. They have said time and time again, going back to past elections, past midterm elections, that Russia, along with other countries, but specifically Russia, has engaged in a pattern of trying to influence the electorate, trying to run disinformation and influence campaigns to impact the U.S. election. And they say that Russia has done this, and other national security agencies of other countries have accused Russia of doing this elsewhere as well. So it would reinforce what U.S. officials have said is a now established pattern of behavior by the Kremlin in trying to alter U.S. elections. And it fits in with some of what they've said in the past. Again, if proven true, Smirnov's actions look at playing on divides that already exist within U.S. society, amplifying those divides for a political purpose and causing instability and causing tension within U.S. society, which Russia then likes to play off of and amplify because it thinks that it makes the U.S. weaker and makes its position on the international stage stronger.
A fascinating story we'll no doubt hear more about in the near future. Jeff Seldon is VOA's national security correspondent. Jeff, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Anytime.
And finally today, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Brazil for a G20 foreign ministers meeting, where the Russia-Ukraine and Israel-Hamas wars are expected to dominate talks. On Wednesday, he met with Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who disagrees with the Biden administration on the conflicts. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken headed to Brazil for the G20 foreign ministers meeting and talks on Wednesday with President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The independent-minded Brazilian leader has strongly criticized Israel's war on Hamas and the high number of Palestinian civilians killed. He had this to say on Sunday on a visit to Ethiopia.
What's happening in the Gaza Strip isn't a war. It's a genocide. It's not a war of soldiers against soldiers. It's a war between a highly prepared army and women and children.
At the State Department Tuesday, spokesperson Matthew Miller said the Biden administration disagrees with Lula's comments.
We have been quite clear that we do not believe that genocide has occurred in Gaza. We want to see the conflict ended as soon as practical. We want to see humanitarian assistance increased in a sustained manner to innocent civilians in Gaza, but we do not agree with those comments.
One expert says Lula is trying to make his voice heard about matters over which his country has little influence. Rubens Barbosa is a former Brazilian ambassador to the United States. He spoke at a Wilson Center forum via Zoom.
He tried to punch above its weight, trying to influence the war in Ukraine, the war in Gaza, and there are limitations. We should recognize that Brazil, in terms of foreign policy, has no power excess, or has not strength to interfere in this area. On the contrary, we are very strong and we are a power, a world power, in environment, in food security, in energy transaction. We should concentrate on these areas.
Barbosa says he does not know why Lula has been silent on the political situation in neighboring Venezuela. A likely Blinken topic of discussion during the G20 foreign ministers meeting in Rio de Janeiro and his visit Friday to Argentina. Venezuelan's government and opposition met Monday in Caracas to discuss their differing views on the detention of a prominent human rights attorney and an agreement to work on conditions for a free and fair presidential election this year. In Argentina, Blinken will hold talks with its outspoken new president, Javier Milei, who is a staunch supporter of Israel. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.